So right now we have Elizabeth Kelly, who runs the EMF Safety Alliance. She's been a health advocate in this field, focused on public policy for about 15 years. She is also the daughter of the chief designer of the first electric grid in California, and here to talk to us today about smart meters. Welcome.
In the early 1920s, when electricity was first being built out in the UK and in the United States, the electric flat iron was introduced. And all the housewives said, yes, I want one of those, and please power up my house. And they put up with these sagging power lines draped across their front yards, and they were proud of it because they could use this energy, this convenient device, this electric flat iron. They didn't have to stand there and heat up the coals and, you know, heat up the irons back and forth. It was great. And then in the 1980s, when the cell phone was first introduced, people were willing to put up with antennas. But I need my cell phone. You know, I get calls all the time. Would you please come and make this cell tower go away? Well, they're calling me on a cell phone, you know. And when I point that out, they go, but I need the cell phone. I just don't want that near my house, you know. It's an NIMBY issue. But the other thing is now we're being asked to install smart meters in on our buildings and homes, and we're asked to purchase equipment that will allow remote monitoring in our homes of our energy consumption. And suddenly people are waking up, like the people in this room and the people in California are waking up. And this is not the only place where this is happening, but this is a very good example of how people are saying, now, wait a minute, I'm not so sure about this. And there are many issues. But the one I'm here to talk about today is health. If you want to find out more about the other issues, for example, privacy, I would recommend you check with TURN, the Utility Reform Network here in San Francisco, or the Electronic Frontier Foundation, because this issue is being analyzed and argued about literally all over the world. We're really at a turning point right now with smart meters, and it's unfolding daily. As of yesterday, the Division of Ratepayer Advocates within the California Public Utility Commission asked for a health study. That follows on Jared Huffman. Assembly Huffman asked for a health study a couple of months ago, which is now underway by the California Council on Science and Technology. That report will be released in January. So we're making progress in bringing focus to this health issue regarding the smart meters. That's very good. We need to have facts. We need to have a public dialogue. And that's what we're in the process of getting here in California in general. But I'm still going to go ahead and raise my serious concerns about the wisdom of installing smart meters without first doing an environmental assessment and considering the potential for harming people and the environment. Just to give a little background for those who may not know, smart meters are the intelligent endpoints for a new infrastructure. It's the largest technological development in history, in fact. And these are being installed all over the world. And they will monitor our time of use, bill us based on time of use, and encourage consumers to change their behavior in their use of electricity, eventually gas and water, and use that natural resource in off-peak hours. So it's really kind of a big behavior modification program for us, the consumer. The new grid represents the largest technological development in history, as I said. And in the United States, this grid is being set up in concert with state utility regulators. And eventually, if this plan succeeds, the grid would be federally regulated. The old electric grid we have right now is really a patchwork system that started way back in the 1880s, as Dr. Milham said. But in 1965, after there was a major power blackout in the Northeast, resulting in catastrophic losses and a baby boom, my father and other power executives formed the North American Reliability Corporation to ensure reliable bulk power supply through a power sharing arrangement among all public and investor-owned utilities in the United States and then with Canada. And they're still negotiating with Mexico. But they saw the need for a new high power transmission system for power lines that would improve interconnectivity between the utility companies and reliability. The Western United States is rich in renewable energy resources, but has inadequate long-distance electrical transmission capability. Well, the stimulus bill signed by President Obama in February 2009 seeks to solve these problems and more. That bill allocated an initial amount of $4.5 billion to bring the grid into the 20th century, to create more green jobs, and to educate people about energy conservation. I happened to see a C-SPAN television show one night at that time. It was a discussion being held in the U.S. Capitol among top leaders in the United States following a hearing on the national electrical grid. There was Tim Wirth from the UN Foundation, members of Congress, Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi, and others, Energy Secretary Chu, Bill Clinton, Albert Gore Jr., Robert F. Kennedy, representing waterkeepers in NRDC, Carl Pope, representing the Sierra Club, Carl Stern representing SEIU, the unions, and T-Bone Pickens, who now runs a wind association, as you know. They were celebrating the beginning of a new digital revolution called the smart grid revolution, which is modeled after the wireless digital revolution that we've been living with for the last 15 years, when Clinton signed the Federal Telecommunications Act of 1986 into law. A central focus to selling the plan is getting the environmentalists on board early to promote the energy sustainability features and to overcome objections. To help along that part of their role, there was going to be money spent out of this bill for philanthropic activities. That's where the environmental groups came in, and the unions. Both of these corporate manufactured revolutions were launched without first doing an environmental assessment in the public interest to ensure health and safety protections were built in from the start. Here is the current status of the U.S. deployment of smart meters across the country. The solid blue states have more than 50% rollout. The striped states have less than 50% rollout. The goal is 51 million smart meters by 2012. PG&E in California has already installed more than 7 million since early 2009. You can see that on their website. They have a little clock, you know, because they're just putting them in all the time. Here's a digital schematic of what a smart grid looks like. Consumers will want electric car chargers, home-based power generators from wind and solar, and these will connect to one another in the energy resources from the utility, all regulated by the smart meter. Inside, consumers can opt to install home area networks like Zigbee Alliance, which has an open global operating standard to permit remote control over, for example, your thermostat, and encourage you to buy and install more and more electrical appliances and wireless-enabled devices that talk to one another using Wi-Fi and smartphone frequencies. Outside, the smart meters will collect and transmit data to the utility through the nearest wide area network. In the U.S., some meters will serve as hubs to other meters as part of a mesh network, and they will transmit data on behalf of the neighborhood. So some meters are going to be busier than others. To do this will require a variable duty cycle and location pings, which will cause intermittent high bursts of radio frequency radiation, pulsed signals. Some meters are going to be more active than others. So the key questions are, at this point, are there any standards governing exposure to electrical and magnetic fields? And how does the FCC radio frequency radiation guidelines apply to smart meters? Finally, are biologically based standards needed to protect health and the environment from increasing air pollution caused by electrosmog conditions? This is really what we're dealing with at this point, is an air quality issue that requires regulation to protect public health. We know how to do that. Here in California, John Goldschmidt, who preceded Raymond Neutra at the California State Health Department, wrote the air quality standards that were adopted later on by EPA. There's a model for how to do that. This is a schematic given to me by Stephen Scott, who's an RF engineer and remedial electrician, showing the spike from a smart meter burst. That's the highest peak on the chart. And compared to, say, a cell phone, it happens less often according to this particular oscilloscope reading. But it's really not a clear picture of what we've got going on here. Some people say that 45 seconds a day is about how often these smart meters will transmit. Other people say, well, it'll transmit every 90 seconds. But really, we don't know. In fact, we're having trouble finding any facts out. And I've tried. Believe me, I've tried. I've called these companies. I've asked for information nicely. I didn't take anything that wasn't given to me. And I didn't get a lot of callbacks, and I didn't get any clear answers. So that makes me very, very concerned about transparency here. In addition to the mesh networks, there are co-located meters, such as shown in this apartment complex. Well, where then do the smart gas meters go and the smart water meters go? Well, they're going to go right alongside the smart electrical meters, so they're going to be triple the radiation patterns happening. And if you happen to live next to this little nest of meters, you might want to move. An RF engineer named Rick Tell, a consulting engineer here, did a comparative chart, which is frankly what the industry likes to do, explaining what the energy output is from different wireless technologies. And so by comparison, smart meters, you know, they don't do too much compared to, say, sitting in a cyber cafe, Wi-Fi cafe, or standing within 2 inches of a microwave oven, which I don't think many people do that. But the comparisons are based on output. They're not based on energy absorption into living tissue, which was really what we are talking about. So it's a different framework entirely. Yes, it may work, but does it really work for our bodies? This is the chart showing very simply the short and long-term exposure coverage given by the FCC in the human exposure guidelines for radio frequency radiation. As was stated already, public exposure is protected for 30 minutes. Workers are exposed every 6 minutes out of the hour. Do you see telecom workers scrambling up and down ladders every 6 minutes? No, they're not paying any attention to that. And chronic exposure does exceed 30 minutes. So we don't really have any relevancy what's going on in the world right now with these standards. And what is not known, what is not being looked at, is long-term exposure. A woman in Ontario, Canada, recently told me that she became electrically hypersensitive after a successful 24-year career where she used a cell phone, lived near antennas, so she retired and moved out to the country. And Hydro-Canada put a smart meter by her house. They wouldn't remove it. She had it put way at the end of her property. She could still feel it. She had copper mesh put behind it. She could still feel it. Now she doesn't know what to do. But a friend of hers who subscribes to Toronto Hydro Energy was told she could get a phone line cable so she wouldn't have to have a smart meter. There are a number of suggestions from RF engineers about how to do this right, but unfortunately, I'm running out of time. But there are very concerned consulting engineers who take measurements of exposure for people who are very competent. They've been looking at this too, and they're working hard to come up with an exposure metric. And they have a number of questions about what kind of exposure we're receiving and how to test it. I wish there were more time so I could run through these. I'd like to just end, which is a little earlier than I planned to, but I'm trying to stay within the time frame, by telling people that in 1997, I was one of the leading appellants challenging the Federal Telecommunications Act, Section 704. We filed an appeal in the appellate court level, because we believe that 704 is wrong because it preempts states from looking after the health of the people when they have to place antennas over the objections of people like ourselves who are concerned about health and other things. Well, we also challenged these guidelines as being inadequate, and we supplied over 4,000 pages of science. Our American court system doesn't look at science. The case was denied. And Whitney North Seymour is going to be speaking in a few minutes, led our Supreme Court appeal with a passionate brief on our behalf. And he'll be speaking to you now, and I'm going to end my comments right now. Thank you.